Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The great Mark Twain died in 1910. In 1954, a little-known actor named Hal Holbrook brought him back, put on the big mustache and white hair and white suit and attitude, and made Twain live again for generations of Americans. He's played many other roles, but this one is his one-man show, Mark Twain Tonight. He came to define him. He performed it more than 2,000 times.
Man is a reasoning animal. Such is the claim. Though I do think that's open to dispute.
Open to dispute. Twain launched Holbrook's career and stayed with it. He's gone on to win 5 Primetime Emmys, a Tony, and an Academy Award nomination for his role in Sean Penn's Into the Wild. He played Deep Throat in All the President's Men and much more. But there's Twain. This hour on Point, Hal Holbrook, the boy who became Mark Twain. You can join the conversation. Have you seen him do it? Put Mark Twain on stage. What's your favorite Hal Holbrook moment? Your favorite Hal Holbrook role? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Let's listen to just a little more. In his one-man show, performed since 1954, he brings Mark Twain to life through the author's own words. Here's Hal Holbrook delivering some of Mark Twain's iconic humor.
Oh, I used to tell lies, but I've given it up. The field is overrun with amateurs. Why, when I look around me and contemplate the lumbering, slovenly lying of the present day, it grieves me to see a noble art so prostituted. In my day, a liar was a liar. I don't mean to suggest that the custom of lying has suffered any decay. It couldn't, for the lie is eternal. It is man's best and surest friend, and it cannot perish from the earth while Congress remains in session.
Hal Holbrook bringing us Mark Twain in his show Mark Twain Tonight. Joining me now from New York is Hal Holbrook, acclaimed actor, best known for his one-man show right there, running for nearly 60 years. Many, many other roles and awards as well. His new memoir is Harold, the Boy Who Became Mark Twain. Hal Holbrook, thank you so much for being with us. Wonderful to have you here.
Thank you. I think my voice has cleared up a little since that recording.
It sounds pretty great right now. You're 86 now, and you were performing this just last week in Opelika, Alabama. How did that go?
It went well. I played there about 13 years ago, before, and I got a better response this time, I think, than I did back then. And I had some pretty heavy, tough material to put over, especially in a small area like that in the South. But mostly, you know, the stuff that I have in the show now about corruption on Wall Street and in corporations and things like that. They took it well, and they took the religious stuff well, too.
You've dipped into Twain to make it timely again and again. You famously write about
it. His material is so timely. It's startling sometimes, and so I watch what's going on in the world. I listen to the news, if you can call it the news anymore. It isn't the news. It's arguments. I watch it until it makes me mad, and then I turn the TV set off. And it gets me fired up to do the show. And I try to figure out as honestly as I can what's going on in the people's minds. I've watched the different networks from MSNBC way over on the left to Fox News way over on the right and try to figure out what's really happening and pick material from Twain that will speak to what people must be really worried about and thinking about or need to be thinking about and in my own opinion.
I love your new memoir. It gives such an intimate picture of what it's like to get started in show business, in your case. And, of course, with a particular background and family history, we'll look at that. But you've got these wonderful descriptions. First of you and Ruby, your first wife, you had a show in which Mark Twain was just a piece of the show, right? And you had lots of others in there, characters from Moliere and Shakespeare. You had Victoria and Albert and Disraeli and Old Queen Victoria and Elizabeth and Essex and Mark Twain. You were playing all kinds of characters. Did you have any idea back when it was more of a variety show that Twain would be the one who would stand up and stick with you?
Not really, although, you know, we found that the Mark Twain number, which incidentally was his sketch called An Encounter with an Interviewer, which is a burlesque, it's a burlesque of what you and I are doing now. Mm-hmm. Ruby played the interviewer. We put that at the end of the show pretty soon on because we found that we could get off with our life better with that number than any other. So
right.
We were playing in the beginning. We were playing high schools. The first job we had was when you get out of school. We developed this in college, and we had been offered a job to tour school assemblies in the Southwest. Down in Texas, Oklahoma, and Arkansas, Louisiana, and we were playing high school supposedly, but it was like kids from the second or third grade all the way to the 12th, and it was survival, man. You had to learn to survive on the stage, and the stuff we were doing, they had never seen before. They had never even seen theater stuff, but we weren't doing easy stuff, so. We did 307 shows in 30 weeks and traveled over 30,000 miles in a station wagon at 80 miles an hour.
An old Woody, if I'm looking at the thing right here.
An old Woody, yeah.
Fantastic.
48.
and these stories, I mean, they're with Ruby, and then later on your own, after that first Pennsylvania solo performance in 1954, and you'd be out there driving hundreds of miles on your own between performances of Twain and tweaking, tinkering as you went. You got these great descriptions of driving through the night in the great American West from one town to the next, the air rushing in through the windows, and you trying to figure out this guy, Mark Twain.
Yeah, and I would, I put on material by the carload in those days. I kept putting it on to test how the material would go, and in various places in the country, it'd go one way and maybe different in another. But I would be riding along, doing 80 miles an hour, and I'd have a tablet on my knee and a Twain book on the seat beside me, and I would be trying to avoid the oncoming trailer trucks.
Right.
And at the same time, I'm trying to redo some of the material I'd done to see if it could be done better.
And trying to figure out a career and trying to make a living. Here's a little more of Hal Holbrook with Mark Twain and his ambitions.
When I was a boy, my comrades and I had one permanent ambition to be a steamboatman. Boy after boy managed to go on the river. By and by, I ran away, too. I said I would never come home again till I was a pilot and could come in glory.
Home in glory. 1954, the first Mark Twain Tonight performance. 1956, it turned out that Ed Sullivan saw you play Mark Twain. He put you right on the big Ed Sullivan show. Was that the glory moment? Did that make you? Even after that, you were out driving and driving and driving through the night, Al.
Well, I was surprised, frankly, by the effect that show had because, they could raise my fee. Mm-hmm. I think I was doing the show for about $100, and I think I got $150 after that. and it raised my visibility, and Steve Allen put me on shortly after that, and right. He was very good to me. And I just started moving. The show started moving. This started out purely as a way to get bread on the table. Mm-hmm. We had moved to New York, and we had nobody to pay our bills except ourselves. We had $200 in the bank when we moved to New York. I was pounding the pavements. I got no jobs. This was desperation to try to get enough bread on the table with a $35 show in Long Island somewhere. And that's how it started. I had no idea it would ever turn into anything compared to what it turned into. But it just took off on its own. People seemed to, they liked it. They liked it. They liked this man. They were willing to listen to him. Even some of the things you've been playing off a record that's 50 years old.
Yep.
The material I'm doing today is considerably different. It's on point.
Good.
What's happening this morning in the newspaper.
Mm-hmm. And there's enough with Twain that you can almost always dip in and find your way to that. And you can do it because you spent a lifetime working through that material. You know him inside and out.
Well, it's amazing what the man said. I mean, you want me to give you an example of
what
please. I'm talking about?
Yes, please.
Okay. Great republics do not last. Whatever has been the rule in history may be depended upon to remain the rule. History repeats itself. Vast power and wealth corrupt a nation. It incites dangerous ambitions and could bring the republic down. It can pap the Supreme Court with members friendly to its purposes, run down the Congress, and crush the people's voice. This has been a strange panic. It's like a blight, a paralysis, in which a mighty machine has slipped its belt and is still running.
Hal Holbrook, hold it right there. You couldn't bring us more up to date. We've got a break right in front of us. We'll be back with Hal Holbrook. His new memoir is Herald. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we are talking this hour with acclaimed actor Hal Holbrook, the man who became Mark Twain for more than half a century, much more now. He's been putting on the makeup and the attitude and performing Mark Twain tonight. He's out with a terrific new memoir, Herald, the Boy Who Became Mark Twain. Joins us today from New York. Boy, that was as up-to-date as it could get just before the break, but let's hear a little more from Mark Twain tonight. Here's Hal Holbrook on that recording he describes.
Well, that California get-rich-quick disease of my youth spread like wildfire. It produced a civilization which has destroyed the simplicity and repose of life, its poetry, its soft romantic dreams and visions, and replaced them with a money fever, sordid ideals, vulgar ambitions, and the sleep which does not refresh. It has created 1,000 useless luxuries and turned them into necessities and satisfied nothing. It has dethroned God and set up a shekel in his place.
Hal Holbrook from Mark Twain Tonight. Hal Holbrook joins us from New York. And Hal, what you were reading for us from your current version of this show was so on point, as you say, so right on top of what so many people are feeling and thinking about. But I wonder, I have to, in all honesty, as much as I love, we all love Mark Twain, I might be frightened to go the distance with Mark Twain. He ended up in such a dark place, such an acerbic and dark place. Here you
No, he ended up, everybody dismisses Mark Twain.
That's not dismissible
on
my
part. Being a cynic. Mark Twain is not a cynic. Mark Twain is telling you the truth about what's going on in the world today, and nobody is listening to it. Now, in the electronic world, Mark Twain does not fit in too well because he takes his time when he speaks.
Mm-hmm.
He's not rushing through. I'm not in a hurry.
Mm-hmm.
When he says something, I want the idea to land. You had to cut me off in the middle of what was a very important quote, so it didn't make a heck of a lot of sense.
Well, I thought it did, but I'd love to hear the rest, and I apologize for that. We were up against a break. I'm very happy.
Well, I know that. I'm not criticizing you.
Mm-hmm.
I'm talking about the world we live in, and that Mark Twain, you cannot squeeze Mark Twain very well into the little straitjacket of time that we have to live in today. It's a different world. And that's what it becomes when people come to the theater and come to see the show. It's a different world.
Is it possible?
But it's a world. It's a world, Tom, that is so identical in so many ways to the world we live in now. And I never update the material. I don't update the material.
It's amazing.
That people will say to themselves, I can't believe this was said 100 years ago. Can I complete the
quote? I would love it. Please do. Ramp us back up to that.
Huh? All right. A blight has fallen upon us. Wait a minute. It's hard for me to get in the middle of it.
Well, pick it up. If we repeat a little, that's all right.
Yeah. Just give me a moment, okay?
Sure.
A creepy and awful stillness has given us an air of apprehension. The phrase laying off has become common. The laying off of 1,000, 2,000, and 3,000 men has become familiar. But there is a far greater and more disastrous laying off going on all over this land. The discharging of 1 out of every 3 employees in all the small shops and industries from one end of America to the other. A blight has fallen upon us, and the monarchy of the rich and the powerful are the author of it. I had not expected the monarchy to come so soon, but it is here, and it is sitting on the throne. Unquote.
Wow. How do audiences respond to that? You could not be more right. It is just as on the money, on point as it could be right now.
They listen to it very intently, and there's a big silence. And one of the techniques that I have followed for years, because it seemed to be the only way to do it, I allow people to think, because a lot of this stuff is foreign to them. They're not going to read it in the newspaper because their newspaper is slanted in one direction or another. Mm-hmm. I mean, my wife's home and our home, we live in Los Angeles, or we did. Dixie Carter. But her home is in Tennessee, and I go there. I'll be heading there next week. Mm-hmm. I'm a little tiny 2-gas pump town. You cannot even get USA Today without traveling about 15 miles. You couldn't get the New York Times without traveling 45 miles, and then you have to go to Starbucks. People don't get the information about what's going on, and I'm speaking to audiences sometimes like that, you know, and I know this stuff is pretty challenging. So his stuff is so, as you can just, you know, tell from what I said there. I mean, it's so eerily
you almost wonder how
modern.
How could it be so true then and so true now? I mean, you're talking 100 years or more since some of these things were written, and yet they land just like that, just like that. Hal Holbrook, in your memoir, it was really interesting to read how, when, as you say, you were desperate, you were looking to put food on the table, and it was no joke. You needed the money. You needed these jobs. You'd drive hundreds of miles for them. You'd study the Twain as you went. At the beginning, even on the humor side, you write how it wasn't that easy to figure out how Twain got the laughs, how to deliver this, how to put it together so that you got the laughs. Now you've done it for a lifetime. You've got the humor and a whole lot more here. What was the sort of arc of you coming to understand Twain as you grappled with this character?
Well, I just became fascinated with the fact the man seemed to be telling the truth, and to hear the truth, you've got to really listen hard for it these days. And the same thing happened 50 years ago. I mean, people are afraid of, well, we're just you know, people don't tell the truth. And people are afraid sometimes, like religion. You know, I used to run into a lot of resistance to any religious, any comedy takeoff on religion, mm-hmm. you know.
In Twain's words.
Which mm-hmm. he loved to do.
Sure.
I laugh at it still. When I'm swimming, I swim every day when I'm home. I run over the lines that I'm going to do in the night. And I run over this stuff maybe that I've done for 30 or 40 years. Mm. And I'm laughing. People at work for me at home hear me laughing out there in the backyard. They know I'm not going crazy. They know I'm laughing. You got a minute here?
Yes. What have you got?
Yeah. So, I mean, first he talks about Noah and the ark.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
Noah
yeah.
getting going out. Noah went out. I'll quote now. Noah went out and began rounding up those creatures, a pair of each kind. We don't know how long it took him or how much it cost. There's no record of that. All been hushed up. But it probably took upwards of 3 years and cost about $4.5 million for transportation and wages. And then one day, an excited stranger arrived in town with the news that thousands of strange animals were coming at top speed. Haven't heard about the embarkation. Dinosaurs 100 feet long and 30 feet high and twice as quarrelsome. And they weren't coming in pairs. They were all coming. They hadn't heard about the passenger list being restricted, you see. And they wouldn't give a rap for the regulations anyway. They would sail on the ark or know the reason why. I mean, I love that.
On there. But
I love that. But, you know, 50 years ago, yeah. If I'm playing in Iowa, you know, I could get a lot of silence on that.
Well, I mean, but then there's the part as well on Noah's Ark. Doesn't he say, you know, you'd like to get all humanity on the Ark and then put an auger to it, drill a hole in the bottom?
Yeah, well, he's just pointing out. I mean, Mark Twain knew the Bible backwards and forwards. He knew the Bible. He had read the Bible because he was brought up to read the Bible,
sure.
for one thing.
Mm-hmm.
But he was a reader. You know, he read Carlyle's Revolution. I don't know how many times he read the Bible. So he knew what he was talking about, and he had a... you know, he had a great respect for the Bible, but he also was able to see the humorous side of man's idea. The people who think Mark Twain was criticizing the fact of religion don't get the point. Twain was criticizing our use of religion to make it okay.
Mm-hmm.
For example, if we lynched a, quote, N-I-G-G-E-R on Saturday night and went to church on Sunday morning, were we really a Christian?
Mark Twain,
we thought we were.
He was having none of that.
You're damn right he wasn't. It's the hypocrisy that we live with. We're nice people, all of us. We're nice people. We're trying our best to make a living and get through the day. But we're not really thinking long enough. We don't have time to think. We're trying to get food on the table. And we tend, as he called the great gullible public, unquote, Mark Twain. Here's another quote.
Yes, please.
I do a number on elections. He said, the candidates rearrange the facts to suit themselves and keep the lies and half-truths spinning in the air while the great gullible public cheers and shouts and stomps its approval the way they always do when a politician has just said something they don't understand.
Just cheer and shout the great gullible. Hal Holbrook is with us. He's played Mark Twain tonight since 1954. He's author of a wonderful new memoir on the beginnings of his life and career. It's called Harold, the Boy Who Became Mark Twain. He joins us from New York. Hal, we've got so many listeners who want to speak with you. Let me bring some in. Port Allen, Louisiana. Ron is calling. Ron, you're on the air with Hal Holbrook. Thanks for calling.
Is this Indiana?
Hi, Mr. Holbrook.
Louisiana, sir. Louisiana.
Yes, sir.
Oh, Louisiana, yep.
Hi, Ron, you're on.
Are you down
Mr.
near
Holbrook,
Houma?
Well, yes, I am.
Well, that's what I figured.
My fondest memory of Mr. Holbrook doing Mark Twain, my wife and I got married about 40 years ago, and we scraped up money to go see him in New Orleans. And it was a wonderful evening, but the thing that I remember, and I think this is my wife's favorite memory too, is he was sitting in a chair talking, and at one point he fell asleep. And he stayed asleep for an uncomfortable amount of time, but there was not a sound in that theater. Not a sound. He had such command of that audience. And that's the memory I have 40 years later.
You were ready to let Hal and Mark have a little snooze on stage and stick with it.
It was great. It was great. And Mr. Holbrook, I understand you're coming to Baton Rouge, and we're certainly going to try to see you again.
Thank you very much, sir. That was his grandfather's old ram. That's when that old miner was telling the story, and it got so long and involved and off target that he fell asleep.
Right. It was a wonderful moment.
That's wonderful.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ron. Thank you so much. And one more, Martin in Chesapeake, Virginia. Martin, you're on with Hal Holbrook.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Mr. Holbrook. It's a pleasure to speak with you. Wanted to share a memory that I had. Back in the late 60s, 68, 69, enough time has passed that you'll forgive me for not remembering exactly when it was. I was 8 or 9 years old, and I was given a ticket, a single ticket, to go and see you play in Columbus, Ohio. So my parents dressed me up in a suit and tie and brought me to the theater. I was, of course, awed by the chandeliers. It's the first time I'd ever been anywhere like that. They ushered me up to the balcony, put me in my seat, and I was a little nervous and kind of overawed, and then the curtain opened up and you came out, and I was mesmerized from start to finish. It was just a thoroughly delightful, entertaining performance, something that the 8 or 9 year old boy has never forgotten and frequently has thought back on and remembered fondly. And I just wanted to thank you for that experience.
Thank you very, very much. That's really sweet of you to tell me about that. That's wonderful. Was that in Norfolk or something where you saw it?
No, that was in Columbus, Ohio.
Oh, Columbus, Ohio. I thought you were in the Chesapeake.
Yeah, he is now.
I am in Chesapeake now, then I was in Columbus.
Oh, yeah, Columbus. I went to college near there. I went to college over in Granville at Denison University.
And
thank you. Thank you so much. That's really that's lovely when
thank
people
you.
Have
thank
these
memories. Thank you, Martin. Yeah, there's a lot of them lined up. When did you know, Hal Holbrook, that you were onto it here, that Mark Twain had this much energy in it, that audiences would be so receptive to it? When did it click in your mind and say, oh, my gosh, this might be it,
well,
the way?
Well, you know, I was astonished, frankly. I think that's the right word, by the reception. I mean, my first real tour was 1956, and it started in the South. 1956, in the South, it started in Alexandria, Louisiana. It was a woman's club. And I did one of the numbers from Huckleberry that I had. The only one I had at the time was the shooting of Boggs and the attempted lynching of Colonel Sherburne by the lynch crowd and his speech to the lynch crowd. And in those days particularly, it was a very volatile piece of material to do because it's Mark Twain's speech to the Ku Klux Klan is what it is. You know, if you read it, it's clear. And I did it. And along with the other material, and the audience listened carefully, and they were terrific. And then the next morning, I went over and played Nacogdoches, Louisiana, in a state college, and I got the same response. And I thought, wow, this is amazing. People will listen to this man, even on a volatile subject that's right on the top of the news.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour with the great actor Hal Holbrook. Played so many roles in a long career, multiple Emmy winner, Tony winner, Academy Award nominee, and recently for his role in Sean Penn's Into the Wild. 86 years old now, still performing just last week in Opelika, Alabama. He's with us today from New York City. His new memoir of the first 30-plus years of his life, Harold, the boy who became Mark Twain. Here he is with a bit of Twain, where Twain's talking about, and Holbrook has lived through tough times and civil rights and much more, talking about bravery in the face of challenge and tough times.
When I was a boy, I saw a brave gentleman deride and insult a lynching mob and drive it away. For the truth is that no mob has any sand in it in the presence of a man known to be splendidly brave. But where should such brave men be found? If physically brave men would do, why, that'd be easy. They could be had by the cargo. But morally brave men and women who can face up to church-going gangs of hooded murderers don't seem to be very many morally brave people left in stock. We appear to be in a condition of profound poverty there. What we really need is some starters. But where should we get them? Very well, then, let's advertise
for morally brave people. Profound poverty there. Hal, do you still use that passage?
No, I don't. No, I think better material than that now, but I haven't used that for many, many years. But what I use is still loaded with bombs. You know, incidentally, Tom, it occurs to me we're talking about Mark Twain all the time. The book is not all just about Mark Twain. It's about this little boy who was basically abandoned by his parents.
We should tell us about that, your mom and your dad.
And how this little boy survived. I mean, he had nobody. I mean, my mother deserted us, is the way they look at put it today. They didn't talk that way then. I was 2 years old. My sisters were 1 and 3, and they just left. She left, and my father followed. She just disappeared into the wild blue yonder. I saw her once again briefly when I was 5, and that's it. And my grandfather, who was 60 years old, took these 3 little children and took us to South Weymouth, Mass., down there where you are, and raised us in the house that he'd built for his mother in South Weymouth, down on off Columbia Road there. And I think the street used to be Shaw Road, and it's now Sargent Road. And he raised us till he died at the age of 12. And I was sent away at the age of 7 to a boarding school to make a man of me. That's the way it was in New England in those days, or the 1930s, and it was tough.
With a fairly cruel headmaster.
And a very cruel, weirdly psychologically motivated headmaster who, you know, liked to beat you and never tell you why. And you lined up outside his office after, you know, the assembly, and you went in, and he said, take your pants down, and both of them, and lean over the chair and take a hold of the arms of the chair, and he'd be getting a 1x3 packing crate slat out of the closet, and he'd start beating you, and he beat you till you cried. Well, you didn't want to cry because the other guys were waiting outside, and you didn't want to be a sissy, but you know, by about 7 or 8 of those whacks on your rear end, you started breaking down and you cried, and then he stopped. That's all he wanted. And you pull your pants up and leave. One time I went out of there, and I tried very hard to contain myself so I wasn't crying in front of the guys, you know, the boys. And I saw down the hall, I saw a woman standing by the open door of a room, and I realized I had a piano lesson. It was a young woman, a lovely young woman who was very kind. And I thought, oh, my gosh, I have to go in there. So I went in there, and she obviously had heard what had happened. She looked very serious. She closed the door. Yeah. I walked over to the piano bench. I sat down. I thought, how am I going to do this and not cry? She pulled a chair up close to me and sat next to me and said nothing. Just sat next to me close. Mm-hmm. I put my hands on the keys. I tried to remember. Well, I was trying to learn to play America two-handed.
Yeah.
And suddenly I started to cry. And she put her arms around me. I never forgot it. Mm. I never, ever forgot that kindness from that young woman, from a young woman who could be a mother. You know, I never forgot it.
Her arms around you when you really needed it.
What?
Her arms around you when you really needed those arms around
you. Yeah, I really needed it. And, you know, it's moments, I think I said in the book, it's moments like that, little moments like that. You wonder how a little boy like this survived. How did he keep going? How didn't he? Why didn't he quit? Why didn't he go into, mm-hmm. you know, some crazy thing? Why did he keep moving and keep trying and keep trying? Because once in a while, some act of kindness would touch you, and you realized you could go on. It gave you the fuel to go on and the hope to go on. Somebody was kind to you.
That fear of going crazy wasn't just a wild idea. I mean, your father spent time in what was then called an insane asylum. I read in your memoir, Hal Holbrook, I mean, you yourself had fears about you. If your father's done that, you can't help but wonder yourself, will that be me? That crossed your mind.
Yeah, I mean, you know, in those days, I mean, we're talking back there in New England, mm-hmm. where you are. That's where my folks come in one of those early boats, 1635, the Goldenrod, I think it was. Mm-hmm. But anyway, yes, in those days, there was a very strong feeling that insanity could be hereditary. You know, psychiatry, nobody even heard of such a thing. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't have it in my mind very much. But, you know, my grandmother, for example, who took over and tried to raise us indifferently, but she tried, you know, after Grandpa died. And when I would get overexcited or emotional, she would look at the person that we were with and roll her finger around her temple and say, just like his father, just like his father. You know, I mean, these things are incidental, but they stick in your mind. And you know, when Thomas Levine, the editor at Farrar Straus, the editor of my book, mm-hmm. when he said, I know he said there are three themes in this book. I said, three? I said, it's about survival. He said, yes, it's about survival, but there are two other things. One of them has to do with fear of insanity. Mm-hmm. I said, no kidding. He said, yes, think of it. And the other has to do with your mother. I said, my mother? I never think of my mom. I never worried about my mother. She took off. I figured she had a reason. Hal, he said, where do you think you got this talent? Where do you think you got this impish quality from those sober-sided people in New England? This is your mother.
This sort of elfin dancer figure we see in the photographs here.
This is your mother who was in the theater. They never told me. Because the theater, show business, that was off. Nobody mentioned. So I didn't even know she was in show business till I was 12 years old and I found her trunk in the attic.
All you've got are the photographs here, her standing in front of some, looks like Model T or Model A, I don't know what, very old automobiles and in some old short culottes doing a dance.
Well, she was bent over and she was out behind the Palace Theater in Cleveland, which I have played several times with Mark Twain. My mother was posing there. You know, I put that picture in the book.
But she was gone when you were two. She's beautiful. She looks full of spirit here, but she was gone.
She must have been some kid, I'll tell you.
She must have been. She
must have been a lot going on there that they didn't tell me about back to South Weymouth.
maybe not. Hal Holbrook is with us. Many people lined up to speak with you. Hal, Catherine, in Boston, you're on the air with Hal Holbrook.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hi.
I just wanted to quickly relay a story. In 2003, it must have been, I was finishing high school, just north of Boston, and an English teacher showed us Mark Twain Tonight on DVD in the class, and I remember an entire English class of high school seniors going completely silent for the entire hour and a half period. And that day had a huge impact on my life. I had always known I wanted to act, but that day, that very class, completely set it in stone. I knew that this was what I was supposed to be doing. And that's what I'm trying to do. Now I'm 27, and I'm attempting to make a life.
Well, good luck to you, and thank you. Thank you very much. That's very sweet of you. I've talked to quite a few people who say they got the idea to be an actor from watching me, and that's a beautiful compliment. Thank you very, very much, ma'am.
Do you have any advice for Catherine on that road? You've got some responsibility here. She watched you and made the decision.
She what?
She watched you and made the decision.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you know, it's a tough life. Several of my children try to go into show business. My little grandson wants to go in, but he's convinced he's going to write, produce, and direct his own movies. It frightens me to death because it's a tough, as this young woman knows who just talked to us, it's a tough life. And, you know, that's partly what the book is about, mm-hmm. really, mm-hmm. because it costs a lot. It costs a great deal. Because you have to find out who you are. Mm-hmm. You have to find out who you really are. You have to face the fact that you have hurt other people in order to get what you want, which is the career. You know, sometimes your marriages break up. My first mm-hmm. marriage with Ruby broke up. Mm-hmm. I mean, your children get left behind. And it's really a difficult, difficult life. You know, you have to have a kind of a, what is the word, killer instinct.
Yeah.
To survive in this business. And I think probably in any high-powered business, it's really a killer instinct. When the choice comes between the job, taking the job, or your family, you take the job. And that costs you a great deal, and it costs your children a great deal. And when you get older and start to look back on it, you can see what it costs. And it's too late to change it. You can only try to help it and improve it and whatever with whatever time you've got left. But
yeah.
This is a rough business, boy. And so is, you know, a lot of tough businesses.
There's plenty, but this one, and you here you are, 86, and writing at the end of your book, asking, was it worth it?
Yeah, was it worth it?
Catherine,
a lot of things.
Yeah, I appreciate your call. Let me get one more, if I may, Hal. Bill is calling from Hanover, New Hampshire. Bill, you're on the air with Hal Holbrook.
Hi.
Ah, Dartmouth, right?
Dartmouth. Hal, I had the privilege of touring with you in Death of a Salesman.
Oh,
and you are finest actor I've ever worked with, and also one of the finest men I've ever met.
Thank you so much. Who is this?
This is Bill Cox. I toured.
Oh, Bill! For heaven's sakes!
I would stay on the stage every night and listen to him speak the Death of a Salesman speech, which is in the second act.
This is playing Hal Holbrook playing Willie Loman in Death of a Salesman.
Willie Loman, such a fine portrayal. I mean, he set the standard. He's really, you know, one of the finest actors I've ever worked with.
This is Bill Cox, who's a terrific actor and a wonderful, wonderful part of the company that we were in. We had a good time on that tour.
We did, and I would listen to him every night, and it would be a chore to try to fire him, because that was my job in the play, was to fire Willie Loman.
Yeah.
And I get so caught up with his story.
Oh, yeah.
As you can hear, he's such a good storyteller.
Yes, we hear it. Wow, with the killer instinct and all the rest, and there you were having to face that down and fire him. Brave man. Bill, thank you for calling.
Thank you, Bill.
Pleasure to speak with you. Thanks.
God bless. You're up there in Hanover, huh?
Yes, right there. Yeah. There's Willie Loman. There's Mark Twain. When you look back across the whole span, Hal, what do the roles stand out as most important to you in your career?
Well, it's hard to say that Mark Twain doesn't, but playing King Lear was a tremendous. I played it twice,
mm-hmm.
and you know, it's a mountain. It's a mountain you can't reach the summit of. Mm-hmm. You can only try. You can try, but it was a great experience. That and doing Willie Loman too, but. And I had a wonderful experience with Shylock, too.
Mm-hmm.
I did, you know, when I do something, I research it. I mean, I go back into the files. I go to the University of Judaism when I did Shylock, and mm-hmm. I researched the files back in the Middle Ages. And boy, I'm telling you, you would be disgusted and horrified at the way Jews were treated back then.
Mm-hmm.
And you would understand why Shylock felt the way he did,
mm-hmm.
because they were treated like dogs. It's terrible. It's embarrassing to read it or to see it, the old woodcuts. And mm-hmm. oh, it's just awful.
There's been plenty of awful in history. Twain was very well aware of that. We've only got half a minute remaining, Hal. Put your Twain eye out on the world today. You shared some at the top with us, but what would he be thinking at what we're looking out on today, Hal?
I think he would be deeply and emotionally upset by what is going on, that we have lost our direction. We've lost sight of who we are. We've lost an understanding of why the men at Valley Forge fought through the winter with no shoes sometimes. Horribly frozen. They couldn't even get paid, and Washington asked them to stay on, and they did. And they fought to create this country. And now look at what we got.
Hal Holbrook. His new memoir is Harold, the Boy Who Became Mark Twain. There's a challenge from the man who brought that character so to life. Hal Holbrook, it's been terrific speaking with you. We're very grateful for your time. Good luck with the book, and thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Tom. Thank you very much.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.